Hello, and welcome to The Sound of Economics, the podcast from Bruegel, the Brussels-based economic think tank. I'm your host, Rebecca Christie. I'm very excited about today's episode because we are talking about bond markets, and I love bond markets, and I have amazing guests today. Joining us is Bruegel's board member, the deputy governor of the Banque de France, Agnès Benassi-Quéret, also Bruegel's director, Jeremy Zettelmeyer, and my Bruegel research colleague, Sylvia Merler. We are going to have a great time talking about why a safe asset is such an important thing to have, what that even means in today's world, and if Europe can have one. So with that very brief introduction, Agnès, can you help listeners orient themselves? What are we talking about, and why is it such a critical concept for people who follow financial markets?
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. Hello, everybody. So let me say something very simple. That a safe asset is an asset that is safe. So what does it mean in terms of safety? Three dimensions. The first one is safe asset should have a low credit risk, so low probability of default. Second, it should have a low market risk, so a stable price. And third, it should have a low liquidity risk, so it should be easy to sell. So this is the basics of a safe asset. Then one step further is a safe haven, which is slightly different from a safe asset, because a safe haven sees its demand increase during periods of market stress. So the price increases when the price of risky assets goes down. And so it has a negative correlation with risky assets. And then it contributes to portfolio diversification. A safe asset may not be a safe haven and vice versa. You ask why is it important for financial markets? It's important for different maybe three different reasons. The first one is that the safe asset is a source of liquidity. So the safe asset can be exchanged against liquidity at a stable value at any time.
And by liquidity, you mean cash money, right?
Yes, against cash, yes. At any time, including during market stress. So because it's easy to sell and because the price is stable, it's a good collateral. So you can use it in the repo market. You can use it also, if you are a bank, to get refinancing from the central bank. It could also be useful as a source of liquidity for non-residents. So it's essential. So we may talk about this. It's essential for the internationalization of the euro. So this is first reason it's a source of liquidity. Second reason, it's a source of stabilization. So it's useful to mitigate the stabilization flight to safety when there is a market stress. So for instance, if banks have a lot of domestic sovereign bonds and there is market stress, then it's likely that the spreads will increase between the different euro area countries, and this will be destabilizing for their banks. Second, and related to the first point, it could contribute to mitigating the sovereign bank doom loop. So the fact that banks hold domestic sovereign bonds and domestic sovereigns are more or less supposed to, were more or less supposed to help banks in case of crisis. So if banks hold common EU debt, then this is no longer the case, and sovereign spreads and bank spreads will no longer be as correlated as they used to be. And also because the safe asset contributes to risk mitigation within the asset portfolios due to the negative correlation, or at least a low correlation that I was talking about before. We may discuss this because it's more the case when there are demand shock in the economy than supply shocks. So it's not always the case. And finally, this is the third reason why a safe asset is important, because it's a benchmark for the European capital market or any capital market. So in general, corporate yields are based on sovereign yields. So it's sovereign yields plus a spread. And the spread depends on the different kinds of firms, the sectors, the risk, etc. So if there is a single yield curve for the euro area, then all firms with the same characteristics across the euro area will get the same yield. So it's kind of level playing field, and it's a very good ingredient for the capital market, for the integration of the capital market.
I'm really enjoying how you put that in terms of the euro area, showing the benefits of having this thing. But of course, that implies that we don't have one yet. Before we move on to Jeremy, can you just tell us what in the world exists right now that is a safe asset?
Good question. So we have an international safe asset, which is considered the U.S. Treasury, so the U.S. Federal sovereign bonds. It is an enormous market, more than $30 trillion. Dollars. So this is really the first of all safe assets. Then regionally, you also have, so the Bund, the sovereign debt of Germany, is considered a safe asset also, but not of the same size as the US by far different. In general, I should have said that before, in practice, what are the safe assets? Usually the sovereign debts of advanced economies with fiscal paths that are not too unsustainable are considered as safe assets. So there is one exception, which is the US, which is despite being, well, quite clearly in an unsustainable path, fiscal path, is still a safe asset. But there are, of course, discussion on the future of this safety. And we've seen that a measure of this safety, which is the convenience yield. So the fact that people are happy to hold U.S. treasuries, despite the fact that the return is not as high as they could get somewhere else. So this is called the convenience yield. So it's the additional benefit, non-monetary benefit that is reaped from holding these assets. So this convenience yield is declining. It seems to be declining. So there is a kind of erosion of the safety of the safe asset.
Yes. And as we will hear later on, the U.S. safe asset is not as much recently a safe haven as it has been in the past. And this has led us down some really interesting paths. Yermin, let's anchor this to Europe a little bit more. Agnes was just saying that the U.S. Treasury, because there are just so many of them and it's so well established in the markets, has been the reference international safe asset. What's the situation in Europe?
The way that Agnes defined it, it's a little debatable what sovereign bonds in Europe should be considered safe assets, because, you know, you're not completely sure where you'd draw the line on credit risk, for example, or indeed on market risk. I mean, so there's some volatility in some. And so I'm not going to go there. All right. I'm not going to give you the cutoff. But what is pretty clear is that we have some safe assets, specifically two in Europe, namely the German Bund and the Dutch bonds, that on top of being safe assets have this so-called safe haven property. So their yields tend to go down when there are crises. They don't have it as strongly as the U.S. So for the U.S. it's extreme. When you have an international shock to confidence, the prices of treasury bonds go up and the yields go down. And you have a little bit of this for Germany and the Netherlands as well. You'd used to have quite a bit more of this during the euro area crisis, right? There was a very strong safe haven effect of the German Bund at that point. And at that point, you know, the problem was that it came at the expense, in a sense, of some of the other bonds. So in a stress situation, people sort of fled into the German Bund and out of their national bonds. And this was one of the triggers of that crisis. So, you know, there are several motivations for why you would want to, in a sense, expand the debt securities in Europe that have that property. And one is that the very simple one is that when you have this type of property, people are willing to pay more for it. So this is the so-called convenience yield that Agnes just made. And then it's obviously fiscally, this has a great advantage. It's just cheaper to borrow. And so that is a great attraction. Now, even if you wouldn't have this, having a bond that by virtue of its low credit risk is cheaper to issue than, say, half of the other EU bonds is, of course, an advantage if you channel your public finances through that bond. And so, in effect, you can more or less, the political economy of, you know, the love for common debt in Europe is divided into two groups. A group of countries that almost entirely always support more common debt, because pretty much regardless of how it comes out in the end, whether in the end the yield reflects sort of the average of the euro area or not, they would lower their borrowing costs by borrowing through this channel. And then there's the sort of more exacting question of whether this is a gain for the entire euro area. And then you also have to convince the Germans and the Dutch. And of course, if they borrow very low now, they are not necessarily going to go for it. And so we have a whole debate in Europe going on whether expanding existing EU debt issuance would get us this nice property of having a very cheap form of borrowing that would be good for everyone, including the Germans, or whether it would only be good for the sort of sovereigns that are now paying higher costs of debt. That's effectively what the debate is about at the moment. Maybe just one additional point. There's also a completely different way at coming at this European debt question, which has nothing to do with, you know, borrowing costs, or not much to do with borrowing costs and, you know, the properties of the debt itself. But it's simply that we really want to expand some forms of expenditure in Europe, like defense, like, you know, electricity grids, investment in renewable energy sources, things that have, you know, systemic significance for Europe as a whole, for the EU and maybe beyond. And those sorts of things should probably be financed by common debt. And we don't have a lot of EU debt out there, so it would be possible to find, you know, issue more debt and use it to finance these public goods, provided we then identify a good revenue source, a way to repay it. So these could be country commitments or maybe separate revenue sources. But so if people sort of argue for more common debt, sometimes that's because they think that they want to improve the debt structure of the European Union and overcome our current fragmentation, which, according to a widely held view, which I agree with, means that we punch below our weight. If we pool all our debt, we could, if this is all through the same instrument, probably produce something that's more attractive for international capital markets, that is more conducive to capital market integration in Europe. So this is one way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is just to say we need more of the stuff that would be financed through this common debt. And that set of arguments is a very strong set, which is pretty much independent of the properties of the specific asset that we're discussing here.
Thank you so much for that. I want to remind folks outside of Europe that we're able to have this conversation in part because of a sea change in European policy that happened around the time of the 2020 pandemic. Prior to that, there had been very little joint borrowing at the EU level, a few billion here and there for some very small projects. During the euro crisis, one of the things that came up was the idea of using joint borrowing, and that was initially rejected, which is why you had the creation of the European Financial Stability Facility and the European Stability Mechanism and some other acronyms that came up during that time. These things were all ways to have groups of countries borrow together, but not through the whole EU. It really wasn't until the pandemic that people said this is a big crisis that requires a big commitment and we're going to start selling bonds together. Over the course of the 5 years, we've also seen some evolution in borrowing specific money for specific projects, just sort of separating the borrowing from the spending a little bit. And Jeremy was just talking about this in that, on the one hand, there's how much are we going to borrow? And then on the other hand, there's these very political decisions about what are our priorities and what do we want to spend on? And you can't completely separate these conversations, but they do happen a little bit differently. We're going to come back to all of this stuff, particularly the idea of collective European debt in various forms in the next section of our podcast. But before we do that, I would like to hear from Sylvia, who has a lot of experience working at firms in the actual market. What do European bond markets look like to you? What do we have and what are we missing?
Sure. So obviously, the starting point from a financial market standpoint here is that bonds are the backbone of the entire financial market infrastructure for three main reasons that Agnes already pointed to, really. So the first one essentially is that they are the pricing benchmark of literally everything else. So the yield of safe government bond is the risk-free rate, and corporate bonds, mortgages, business loans, everything really is quoted as a spread on that rate. So this is extremely important for pricing dynamics in the market because the government yield curve is effectively the discount rate that sits underneath every other asset's valuation. So it's extremely important. Second, they are collateral. So government bonds are the dominant collateral in the repo market, which is where banks and other financial market institutions effectively borrow short-term cash. So the whole plumbing of the financial market, of the financial system, relies essentially on sovereign bonds. And lastly, because they are the channel for monetary policy transmission. So whenever central banks alter the path of interest rates, this is primarily reflected in government bond yields. And from there, it is transferred onto every other yield in the market. And from there, it then impacts the real economy. So these are the reasons that make bonds especially important. So in Europe, the euro area government bond market is now roughly about 10 trillion outstanding, with about 1 trillion on top of that, which is EU debt. This is obviously much smaller than the US, but Europe is the second largest market for fixed income in the world. So definitely this is a very important scale. When we look specifically at the EU as an issuer, I think for markets, there are a number of things that are on the technical side that matter a lot when it comes to what EU debt is perceived to be from where I'm standing. The first one, and I think probably the most important, is the index classification. So the fact that major index providers currently treat EU bonds as a supranational issuer. So this would be equivalent to an institution like the European Investment Bank, for example, or the German Development Bank, KfW, rather than an actual sovereign. The EU has tried to change that repeatedly, lost the fight both in 2024 and in 2025 with ICE regarding sovereign classification. And when we look at the reason why the fight was lost, is that effectively ICE argued there is not enough certainty as to the EU status as a fiscal authority to then warrant a classification as a sovereign. So that might look like it's a minor technical detail and a little bit of a nerd part of this conversation, but it is enormously important because it keeps the big benchmark tracking sovereign bond investors out of the market. And so the result of that is that the buyer base for EU debt is kind of skewed toward buy and hold long-term investors rather than the active asset managers and banks that really generate the bulk of the day-to-day liquidity. So lower liquidity, less trading also means wider spread, and wider spread means it's more expensive to borrow compared to alternative national level sovereign benchmarks. So this is an important point. The second, obviously, is the temporary nature, uncertainty about whether supply of these bonds will be there in the long term. And this is also something that has potentially implications on the pricing on the market side of things, because it is not as obvious whether next generation EU debt that is already existing will be rolled over, at what conditions. So from the financial market standpoint, there is uncertainty as to what is the actual amount of supply that you will have available of this particular financial instrument, which has a bearing on whether you decide to diversify away from the US Treasury and into this potential alternative nascent early stage safe asset. Repo and collateral infrastructure is also very important. These are technicalities, as we said, but the plumbing is really important when it comes to pricing as well. The Commission only joined Eurex repo in 2024, which brought the EU bonds into centrally cleared financial financing system that gives the dealers repo access. And so to some extent, this functionality is still a lot less developed for EU bonds than it is for national sovereign bond. And same with derivatives, really. That is also relatively early stages compared to the equivalent national bond markets. Another thing that I would mention, and this goes in the direction that you pointed out, Rebecca, is actually the funding strategy. So there's been a relatively long period of time where the EU was issuing program by program before then switching to a unified funding strategy. And so that somewhat delayed the construction of a coherent yield curve for EU debt, which is now starting to be there, but obviously it's younger and less tested than any alternative national sovereign benchmark out there. And therefore, all these technicalities have a bearing on the status of EU debt for financial markets. That being said, there is a lot of interest in financial market for EU debt, because each and every time the EU comes to the market with a bond, the bond is massively oversubscribed. We're talking 10 to 20 times more demand than there is supply. So this is definitely a signal that markets are extremely interested in this type of instrument. And then if these technical hurdles that I mentioned were to be cleared off the table, then this could really have potential to evolve in the direction of becoming a genuine safe asset, as Agnes was previously talking about.
How would you say this joint EU debt, with its pros, its profile and the investor demand, but also its minuses, this lack of trading as a full sovereign, how does that make it compare to debt from countries like France and Italy, which don't always have the best ratings or the best yields, and yet there's a lot of them. They're very liquid, they're very easy to trade, and a lot of demand in the market. Like, how do we compare there?
Well, again, as I was saying earlier, the key difference there is index classification. So the fact that those are sovereign issuers brings benefit from the perspective of being included in indexes that then are the relevant benchmark for a lot of investors to be tracking or to be modeling their portfolios on. And so that is something currently that EU debt doesn't have. But as discussed, this is something that also opens up a broader conversation about what the EU wants to do with its fiscal authority. Its fiscal capacity and generally the way that it raises resources and whether it plans to roll over the existing debt and how it plans to pay for it going forward, which is potentially beyond the scope of this podcast, but very, very much intertwined. So it is a discussion that should happen in parallel.
Thank you. In the next part of our podcast, we're going to talk about some of the proposals out there about what the EU might do next and ways to think about them. Jeremy, you have a paper coming up now where you look at some of the proposals that are getting the most airtime, and you really do a deep dive into whether these proposals have legs, what we need to know before we move forward, how they might compare to just straightforwardly selling more of the bonds we have now. Tell us what we're talking about, and then we'll come back and talk more about what you found.
Yeah. So fundamentally, if you wanted to issue more EU debt, there are basically two routes to do that. You could find more stuff that you want to finance at the European level as opposed to the national level, and then you would debt finance it through the existing issuance channel that was just described by Sylvia. So by issuing more EU debt. So this would not be the debt linked to the Next Generation EU program. It would be linked to some other thing, but the bonds would be fungible. It would be the same types of bonds that are already circulating in the market, and you would expand the existing market, which is about something 750 billion to something bigger. And then the other way of doing it is to channel some of the national borrowing through EU-level debt. So here the idea would be that national governments would issue debt into the markets, and a portion of this national government debt would be bought by a European intermediary, maybe the EU itself, and then the EU would finance these purchases by issuing its own bond. And then the debt service that the national governments would have paid to the market are instead paid to the EU, right? These are the fundamental two categories of proposals. Now, they each have their complications. So in the first category, if you wanted to just shift more spending to the European level, of course, this has big implications for the spending side, right? You have to first think about what you want to actually spend it for, and can this stuff actually be saved at the national level? Because otherwise, you're just raising the overall debt in Europe, which is not necessarily what is intended here. It's about the composition of debt. So you have to solve sort of a spending problem before you can solve your safe asset or extra debt problem. And that's a pretty big obstacle to agree on that. Another obstacle refers to what Sylvia just explained. So there is a precedent. We have quite a lot of this EU debt in the market, and it's working quite well. So, I mean, remember, this was a tiny market until 5 years ago. Now it's the fifth largest bond market in Europe after France, Germany, Italy, and Spain. And, you know, the liquidity is very high. The yield curve is there. It's a huge success story. And remarkably also, this is AAA rated debt. So this is debt which is more highly rated than France. It's up there with Germany and the Netherlands, with the exception of one of the rating agencies that just gives it a slightly lower notch. But it's really an impressive achievement. But, you know, the odd thing is that even though it is AAA rated, like the Dutch or the Germans, it trades at about the same yield as the average of the euro area or the EU. In other words, there is a significant spread relative to the German Bund, about 50 basis points, sometimes 60, sometimes a bit less. So it's actually as expensive as the average. I don't exactly remember where it sits relative to France, but somewhere close. It is still a bit cheaper to issue than Spain, Italy, Greece, and so forth. But for the average of the euro area, it doesn't do much. And so the big puzzle is, why is this not the case? Why does it get sort of, in a sense, penalized by the markets, even though it is this fantastically safe asset? And the reasons are what Sylvia talked us through. The investor base is smaller, it's not viewed as permanent, and so forth. So the point here is that if you want to go this route, if you want to create more European debt but just issuing more EU bonds, then you probably should be thinking of addressing some of these structural reasons for why it is relatively expensive before you do that. Or you could just go ahead and do it, and then maybe you benefit from structural improvements later. But remember, once you have issued that debt, it's no longer the sovereigns, I mean, not longer the EU that would be benefit from these improvements, but whoever holds the debt once it's been issued. So that's not so great. So this is why this route of let's just borrow more at the EU level is not quite as attractive as it seems, even if we solve this problem of reallocating expenditure to the EU level. Okay, so that leaves then this other type of proposal. And so there are many variants of this, but the most recent famous one is by my former thesis advisor, Olivier Blanchard, and my colleague, Angel Ubide. And so I'm very respectful, and I sort of like both the people and the proposal. And there is, you know, then the question, to what extent would this approach do better than just issue more EU-level debt? And so if you think about these sort of structural impediments that Sylvia outlined, the one that it clearly gets rid of is the temporariness problem, right? So this would be a permanent commitment to issue, say, up to a quarter of national debt through this European channel. And so if you think that, you know, investors are worried that this might not be permanent, well, rest assured, once the state is, this is a commitment to keep it, it could be there. So maybe it would then be treated like really sovereign debt. There is another slight problem. Again, it can be overcome, but it requires some more work, which is, it is not obvious to me that a bond that's issued through this sort of passing on of national revenue to the European level would be rated AAA. So if you think about it, you know, if you ask someone, you know, if something is backed by the average payment commitment of EU members, it probably should reflect the average credit rating of these EU members. However, the current EU bonds, they are rated AAA. Now, why is that? Well, it turns out this is because of a miracle called the headroom. And so what it means is that when these EU bonds were issued, member states committed to repaying not only their share, but if necessary, paying more than their share up to a particular limit to make sure that these bonds are completely safe. And rating agencies bought that and markets bought that. And so this is why these bonds are AAA rated. Now, if you could imagine that there is also a little bit of a political problem in committing this type of, you know, Germany is going to jump in if someone else drops out spirit into a big new issuance proposal, because that's precisely what has been holding back European debt issuance in the past, that, you know, the higher rated borrowers weren't quite sure whether they were only paying for themselves or whether in a crunch they would also be paying for the others. One of the reasons, not the only one, why Germany, the Dutch, and so forth are skeptical against these proposals. So it is hard for me to believe that, as it is currently written down, bonds issued through this second class of proposals would get a AAA rating. But if you then fix that flaw, the only way to fix this is you need some find some additional headroom, revenue source, fund that will provide extra safety. And how are you going to do that? So that is the main problem. One way of doing it would be to capitalize some sort of safety buffer. I don't know, but this is what we have to work on.
And yes, I want to ask you to explain to listeners a key concept that we haven't touched on yet, which is the idea of fiscal space. In theory, no country can borrow forever and ever. You pointed out that even the U.S. is on what now seems to be an unsustainable path. So, what is fiscal space, and what happens if you get it wrong? And particularly, what does that mean for individual countries in Europe versus the EU as a whole?
Oh, this is a very deep question. Unlike companies, governments can force, in a sense, they can force the citizens to buy their products, which are public goods, they just pass new taxes. Whereas if you are a company, you can never force your customers to buy your products. So by construction, sovereigns are safer than companies, even big companies, in theory. But then at a certain point of time, the citizens are no longer willing to pay more taxes, and there is a political unrest. And so this is where you no longer have fiscal space. So in a sense, so I agree very much with what Jeremy said, because from a political economy point of view, what we've done is financing European public good, which was, during the COVID, which actually was not really a public good. It was helping national governments to weather the pandemic. So it was creating additional debt. It was not a debt exchange, which is the second type of project that Jeremy was mentioning. It was really financing a new program. And from a political point of view, it's more concrete. You're going to make joint borrowing for a concrete project, which could be defense, could be something else. The problem is that it comes on top of what governments are already doing in their jurisdictions. And so it adds debt to the debt. So if you don't have the possibility to increase taxation or to cut expenditure nationally, then you don't solve, in a sense, you don't. So this joint borrowing is not a solution to fiscal, fiscal discipline. It's not a substitute, of course. So the debt exchange, a very nice property of the debt exchange is that you can do it with the same level of debt. And you also have projects that link this debt exchange to very tough commitment to reduce a national debt. So this was the old German proposal. More recently, there have been some proposals. So it could have some attraction for some disciplinary countries who are handling their fiscal affairs more seriously than others. However, as Jeremy mentioned, there is an issue of the distribution of the gains, of the total cost of the debt, also for countries with a lot of debt, because they will still have a lot of national debt, which de facto could be made junior, so more costly. And then comes the incentive and the incentives and the moral hazard question. So what if you have a common pool? Isn't this an incentive for profligate countries to spend more and to borrow even more? And so with the fact that the national debt is, in a sense, junior, does it discipline enough the government? So all sorts of questions that are on the table. In theory, you could think as an insurance company. So you have different countries that have different risk, and you are going to charge a different cost for the different countries. So you could think of each country paying its share of the common debt. So in terms of debt service, or more in terms of interest payments, so these interest payments could be indexed in a sense to the spread of each country in order to control for the more hazard. So this maybe could be solved. However, we need to work a lot on this. As a matter of fact, probably having a large amount, a large volume of debt would be the only way to get the safe asset as we were defining before. For the financial markets, you need a large volume of debt. So you need to go for a form of debt exchange. However, doesn't seem to be very attractive for our politicians. So Ettore Doricci and Stefano Rossi have proposed a path that would start from financing some specific projects. And given that they are overlapping, in a sense, the EU would not use the amount of debt because one project would come after another one. So you since you have only one issuer, it would be okay. And then you build trust, and after some years, start having some what Jeremy was mentioning in terms of shared responsibility on the debt and joint commitment.
German, you want to come in quickly?
Yeah, I mean, first I wanted to just endorse this approach by this former ECB economist Ettore Doricci, who co-authored a paper where he basically argues for a gradual approach where you first link more European debt issuance to very concrete and uncontroversial expenditure needs, and then you gradually try and improve the structure of the debt market itself. So I think that seems to me the most realistic way of going about it. But I just wanted to offer another way of framing it that essentially summarizes what Agnès just said. So it's a bit risky because I'm proposing a new trilemma. So I would say it is hard in the current structure, fiscal structure of the EU, to have three things at the same time. One is a triple A rated debt, so very low credit risk. The other one is to avoid moral hazard, so the fact that this triple A rating is produced by, in effect, having Germany stand behind everyone. And then the third part of the trilemma is avoiding fragmentation in the remaining national bond markets. Okay, so now let me prove the trilemma. So suppose you wanted very high, a very good credit rating and no moral hazard. The way to do this is to make the EU debt senior to national debt. And because it's senior debt, it's super safe.
That's really only an issue when you have a hybrid model, right, where the EU is working with the national debt, or is that an issue for EU bonds as well?
We're talking now about these debt swap proposals. Yes. Indeed. So this is leaves the expenditure side unchanged. The question is, we have expenditures at the national level, maybe some at the European level, and we want to finance them more through European channels than through national ones. But the assumption is there's still some national debt in the market. And so if you make this European debt super safe by making it senior, then you are able to avoid moral hazard, because the safety is not produced by the Germans guaranteeing anything. The safety is produced by the seniority. But the downside is that the cost of borrowing in the remaining national markets is going to go up, because this is now subordinated debt. So this is where Blanchard and Ubide come in. So the novelty of their proposal is to say, we're going to reject this approach and we're not going to go for explicit seniority. Rather, we will simply make the assumption that no one defaults on the EU. That's all we need for safety. And as a result, we're going to avoid the fragmentation of national bond markets. Basically, national yields are going to be unchanged. So that's their pitch. And their pitch is, I mean, I believe this is true. It has one downside, though, which is if you want to keep these other two of the parts of the triangle, no fragmentation and no moral hazard, you're going to risk the first part, which is to make this EU debt completely safe. And like I said, debt of this type would almost certainly not be rated AAA, because the way that rating agencies operate is they look at the average credit rating of the sovereigns backing the debt, and they give it that rating, and then they ask, are there reasons to give them a better rate? And so then they look for things like headroom. And once you have something like headroom in there, you are again back to moral hazard. So this is the difficulty of breaking out of this trilemma. Now, there is one way to do it, but it requires real structural work, right?
So we're going to come back to the structural changes that might make that possible. It's a great setup for what I want to ask Sylvia next, which is the role of market signals. One of the enduring paradoxes of the EU is that Germany, which has the safest bonds, sometimes fails to place them in the market. Germany has had failed bond auctions, and they have some technical ways to resolve that, and it doesn't cause long-term problems. On the other hand, Italy, which is sort of famous for having huge amounts of debt out there, the stock of debt in Italy is very high. Every time there's any sort of sovereign worry in the air, people say, is Italy going to be next? And Italy always sells its debt. They market it very well. They find people to buy it. They shove it into the hands of members of their own financial system who they think can take it. The debt gets bought. So given those sort of trade-offs, like, what are the signals from the market here that we should be watching?
So I would say on this specific point, there's also a lot of technicals going into this. Obviously, when market volatility is high, prices are misaligned. For example, the German government has retained chunks of bonds to prevent this from rates from going up. So, I mean, every individual country's bond market is different. The environment in which the issuance happens is different. So it's really a little bit difficult to extrapolate, I want to say, from dynamics that may happen on the national bond market, anything that we should infer from for the EU bond market specifically. So this I would probably not spend too much time on. The one thing that I wanted to go back so that Jeremy can again talk about the technicalities of his proposals, however, is the trilemma, because I am not 100% convinced I agree with him on the fact that there is no solutions to that. And I think actually EU bonds that are linked to projects may offer one way to somehow square this. Because if you think about it, so the elephant in the room is the moral hazard here, because it is effectively what is on one end preventing political agreement on own resources decisions that could make it a lot easier for the EU to then move closer, so to speak, to a federational type of fiscal policy system that would issue debt more credibly in the market, and that debt would be more easily perceived as a safe asset than it currently is. And at the same time, as Termin was saying, when we think about solutions like debt swap, that is at the core of what could produce a segmentation between the remaining bond market, national bond market, and the EU debt market. I think in that respect, if you think EU bonds that are tied specifically to EU policy priorities do have an advantage, which is they reduce the interest rate for national spending that is, however, very clearly tied to a project that is essential to the EU interest. So it is borrowing for a specific reason. Think defense. This is the very obvious case in point right now. Without moral hazard, because it's linked to a specific project. At the same time, it also does not have the unwelcome effect of increasing potentially the interest rate on anything else that the national government were to finance outside of this EU bond issuance that is project specific, because it doesn't necessarily affect the liquidity of the national bond market outside of the EU issuance. So EU issuance comes on top, but that EU issuance is not conditional on a shrinkage in the total liquidity of the national bond market. And so in that respect, I think it fixes that problem. On the AAA side of things, it is true that obviously right now what has been allowing the EU debt to get the AAA rating is the headroom. But at the same time, the idea of issuing EU bonds specifically linked to projects is also a way to reduce fiscal risk at the national level if you assume that these are projects EU countries would need to spend on anyway. So it is not like they wouldn't spend on these things, but it is this spending is being centralized at the EU level in a way that allows for more oversight than otherwise would be possible if this was left entirely to the national level, with potentially more reporting requirement, conditionality, and so on. So I think it isn't entirely impossible for that AAA to stick even without a significantly different agreement on fiscal coordination at the EU level. But maybe I'm wrong, so I'll leave it to Jeremy to point out why.
So this is great. And one thing I tell my friends is that the more you know about bond markets, the more fun it is to argue about them, as opposed to other things that are very exciting at the top level. And then when you get into the details, become very boring. Bonds just get more and more interesting. In the last section of our podcast, I like to talk about what now. So, Jeremy, tell us about your proposal and your response to Sylvia's question, and what should the EU be doing next, and where do you think we should end up?
So, I don't really have a proposal. I have sort of some suggestions. So I think that at least conceptually, the first order of the day would be to address some of the structural impediments that currently prevent the EU debt from having lower yields, lower borrowing costs than is the case now. And so there are two ways you can do this. I think one clearly is to have a commitment that outstanding EU debt will not go below a certain level. So I don't think you need a commitment to necessarily roll over NGEU itself. And in fact, that might be very difficult to do. But the practitioners often point out is that what matters for the liquidity of the market is not whether debt of a particular program gets repaid or not, but whether or not it gets replaced by other things. And so if what we need is an expectation that there will be in a significant liquid EU debt market over the next 50, 60, 70, 100 years, right? But that would require some sort of political statement or commitment. And the other thing that I would try to do is to find some dedicated revenue source for the purpose of EU level debt issuance. That's the crux. I didn't completely understand Sylvia's argument, but I think that, you know, certainly when you have project bonds, which is what she was referring to in a commercial context, there is such a revenue source, right? It is the revenue of the underlying project. We don't have that here in the EU. I mean, defense is not a money-making thing unless you somehow get some service payments, which we could think of. But if we were able to give the Commission direct control over a revenue source that is earmarked for EU-level bond payments, this might be useful in two ways. One is it would increase the sovereignness, if you like, of the EU debt, because a sovereign is defined by their ability to tax. And so we could try to embryonically give this power to the European Commission only for the purposes of debt issuance. But then the other big advantage this would have is if you go back to the second class of proposals where I argued that Blanchard and Dubide is a great proposal, except that I think that because they don't want any headroom because of their moral hazard concerns, it wouldn't be AAA rated. Having this additional revenue source could maybe then do the trick, right? It would be one way of improving the structure of the EU bond level debt that would be issued to make sure that it gets to AAA, and maybe really then the spread to the German Bund would be very low, including because it is viewed as permanent. So these are the two things that I would pursue.
Sylvia, what do you make of that, and what would be your recommendations?
So my recommendations 100% would align with Jeremy on the idea of having a floor for outstanding EU debt. And I think that's not very difficult to do, because if we look at what are the numbers out there right now, we have obviously the almost 800 billion from Next Generation EU. We have the 150 billion that were done on defense. Could have been more if part of the massive German program had been funded at the EU level, but still 150 billion is not very bad.
I agree with that, for the record.
Great. And then we just agreed to fund 90 billion for Ukraine. So, you know, like, there are projects on which we do find agreement around common funding. When you bring all of that together, we easily get 250, 200 billion EPG funding a year that could, you know, like, ensure a reasonably sized supply of EU debt to the market that could provide the liquidity that the market needs. Obviously, we're not close to the numbers in the US, but that isn't potentially even the objective, right? So the objective is to make this instrument something that can have a more functional market, and a market that has a certainty as to what the supply will be and over which time horizon. And so I think with what we already have, we're already pretty much there. I was mentioning technical issues when we talked about it earlier regarding like repos, derivatives. So those are our financial market infrastructure's point that are relatively easy to fix once you do have the supply of debt that can be used to do it. And they have been fixed for the largest part already. So if, you know, like, we're in the World Cup season, if we want to use a football metaphor, the EU has built the stadium. It just needs the crowd to come in. And for the crowd to come in, there needs to be some action for the crowd to watch. And so to guarantee that there will be that action, obviously ensuring that there is a floor of EU debt that remains available for the market, I think it is really essential.
This has nothing to do with Italy not qualifying for the World Cup, right?
What can you do?
For our American listeners, football is, of course, soccer, which is all that Europe can talk about right now in the summer of 2026. I'm here for it. I want to give the floor to Agnes now for closing thoughts, comments on what we just heard. And also, if you can, I would love you to tell our listeners a little bit more about what all this means for central banks and the euro system, because the European Central Bank spends a lot of time working with national debt in all kinds of ways, and a real European safe asset would very much play into that part of the financial system. So take your time and tell us what you think. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Rebecca. So first, let me say that I agree with what Sylvia and Jermaine just said, with the floor on the volume of debt, also dedicated resources. This is very important. It's often the missing leg of the discussion. If you count on national contributions, this will not increase the fiscal capacity of member states. So you just take from one pocket to put in another pocket. And if you rely, as is has been contemplated, if you rely like on ETS resources, well, this is wrong, I think, because you need to use these resources to compensate the losers of climate mitigation policies, which are very difficult. So I think we really need to rethink about these issues of not EU tax, because the EU cannot raise taxes, but some coordination of taxation of the clear winners, which can be companies or individuals, households, winners who happen to be mobile across the EU. So this has some makes sense. So your point was about central banks, and it's true that central banks have a stake in these discussions, because if there is no stable, if there is no safe asset, then central banks will need to substitute as a source of liquidity, as a source of cash for the financial system. So it means, probably it means a larger central bank balance sheet. It also means probably more central bank interventions, like with the TPI or other instruments, in case there is some market stress. So there is a very strong connection with what central banks are doing or may be doing. Perhaps if I have 1 minute to finish with the international role of the euro, because I really think that there is a window of opportunity. The euro area is moving very fast in terms of modernizing its means of payments, the interconnection of its fast payment system, the development of wholesale CBDC, which are going to be very powerful objects that will help make cross-border payments. So for help foreign currencies to use also the euro for payments, and foreign countries actually are also changing their payment system, so this goes the same direction. However, so we also have a euro that is very stable in terms of price stability. Well, there are some bumps in inflation, but still on the medium term is very stable. There is a rule of law. So unit of account is really a strength. And then what is missing is the store of value. So the fact that we don't have this safe asset as well, what we said, the volume, the liquidity of a unified safe asset is really missing, is this triangle, which is not an incompatibility triangle, but you really need to have the three corners of the triangle to make an international currency.
Thank you so much. That is a great note to end on. We are talking, of course, about the euro's maturation from a brand new currency not so long ago to world's number two reserve currency, and maybe in the future, an even growing share of the global financial situation. You've been listening to The Sound of Economics from Bruegel. I'm Rebecca Christie. I have been joined today by Agnès Benassi-Kerré, Jermaine Zettelmeyer, and Sylvia Merler. I very much enjoyed talking about this with you. And listeners, I hope you have enjoyed it as well. You can find Jermaine's paper and all kinds of other good stuff in the show notes on our website, Bruegel.org. All of our content is free to access and share with your friends, as is this podcast. Thank you for listening, and see you next time.